stop me if you've seen this meme. Person A approaches person B and asks them to do some freelance artwork for them. Person B asks, "Does it pay?" To which person A replies, "No, but I can pay you with exposure." Cut to a still from the old video game Oregon Trail that reads, "You have died of exposure." People with a dream to work in a highly competitive field where there is simply not enough supply to satisfy the overwhelming demand when it comes to work placement will always be targets for exploitation. Artists will sell their skills and their product for way less than they're worth simply for the chance to create. And many artists are genuinely happy to do so. And that's great. But I would argue that even the folks who take work for little to no pay simply for the love of it may be opening themselves up to problematic issues like unsafe working conditions, lack of regard or respect for time, and a subpar, unsatisfying product after months of hard work. Honestly, I feel that everyone from the top down, including the audience, is much better served when those in charge do everything they can to make sure that everyone is being protected, fairly compensated, and respected. So why is it then that so many companies and individuals routinely take advantage of the sweet, pure-hearted artists who are just so eager to have anyone accept them and hire them to do something creative? I mean, I don't know, obviously, but if I had to guess, I'd say it's probably the same reason why major clothing companies have their products made in sweatshops where they pay their workers a fraction of what they're worth. Simply put, the reason people choose to exploit workers is because it's cheap and, well, because they can. In the US, we have unions to protect certain vulnerable populations of professionals from mistreatment and to ensure a certain standard of pay and benefits. But many artists and producing entities still prefer to operate outside of the unions for various reasons. Perhaps they feel like they can work more often at non-union houses, or they simply don't wish to go pro and are content keeping their craft merely as a side pursuit. For producers, the issue is usually that they simply lack the funds to pay a standard union wage, so they opt to stay non-professional, offering only what little they can to the artists who choose to come and lend their skills to their cause. So what's the problem? If everyone is doing what they want and everything is transparent, then everything is cool, right? Well, first of all, not all professions in the arts are lucky enough to have a union, so that's the first problem. And second of all, there are sometimes incidences where a producing entity actually has more than enough operating funds to be professional, but chooses to stay non-professional so that the people at the top can make more money and so that they don't have to pay their artists their fair share of the revenue they bring in. Today we're going to be looking at an example that fits this exact description. The Hale Center Theater in Sandy, Utah has been a giant in American community theater for the last 30 years. They utilized a unique brand of audience engagement to build their company from a modest 220-seat house in an old lingerie shop to a multi-million dollar facility with two massive state-of-the-art stages, more than 29,000 season ticket holders, and a whopping $20 million annual operating budget. For anyone who knows what community theaters typically operate on, hell, what professional regional houses typically operate on, you're probably wondering how a company this large could still be technically non-professional and operating outside of the union. Well, first of all, there's simply no law saying that a company has to be unionized when they reach a certain size. Most companies just do it because they believe it offers the best possible working relationship with the artists they hire, and by extension, the best possible product for their audiences. So again, what's the beef here? If Hale isn't breaking any laws, and if the artists they hire are all there voluntarily, and if the audiences are happy, then how can exploitation be taking place? This debate over whether or not Hale Center Theater's practices are ethical or not has been long-standing in the larger Utah theater community. But lately, it's come roaring back into focus on social media after they decided to reopen two productions simultaneously on their two stages during a time when professional houses across the world are closed indefinitely until the unions deem it is safe to reopen. Despite the fact that the CDC has said that singing is a major way to spread COVID-19, The Hail is doing nightly sold-out performances of two musicals with no social distancing between audience members. They've already had to pause the run of their production of Mary Poppins because two cast members have tested positive for the virus. There has been little to no accountability or follow-up on whether these two cast members have spread the virus to their fellow castmates, to the stage technicians behind the scenes, or to the paying customers in the audience. This blatant disregard for basic safety has prompted criticism from many online, but few detractors have had complaints as thoroughly researched as those of my guest today, who noticed that The Hail might be operating on a loophole that technically breaks the law. A loophole that's made it possible for them to take advantage of the artists they hire for years, all while making a fortune for the people at the top in the process. From a Blanket Fort recording studio in my one-bedroom apartment in North Hollywood, this is People Pleaser. I'm Austin Archer, and today I'm talking to my friend Dave Mortensen about artist exploitation.
I couldn't help but post another Facebook post today. And of course, because I was trying to do it, a nutshell version, I made some mistakes because, so Jerry corrected me and I've updated my post. That I feel like that's the biggest problem with trying to convey complex issues to people is no one wants to read a huge long post, but when you boil it down to little principles, sometimes it forgets all the nuance.
That's kind of the toss-up, right? When you're trying to talk about stuff like this is like, well, I need to make it digestible so that people will take a look at it, and I need to make it simple, but also I don't want to just be oversimplifying a complex thing.
Yeah, and I don't want to like feel like I'm, I don't know, what's the word? Campaigning for something that maybe I'm not wanting to say. I don't know. Just because of the oversimplification.
Right. I thought it was interesting when I saw you talking about how they blocked you, of course. They've been blocking everyone. I thought it was interesting when you said that all you were doing was responding to people in the comments with their official press release. And you're like, I really think being like pretty reasonable. Like, I think I'm being pretty.
Yeah, it was just a screenshot of their comments saying what the COVID situation was. And I didn't say anything else. I'm just like, this is what they're saying since they aren't getting back to you in a timely manner. Hope that's helpful.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and take care of their PR for them since they're not responding to people on the internet. This is what they said on another thread, and this is just a screenshot of what they said, not my take on it, and I hope this is helpful. And they're like, hey, man, nobody shows someone else what we said in a screenshot. You're blocked.
Yeah.
Dude, this is wild. It's not like, look, for anyone who's lived in the Utah theater community, who's come up in that theater community, this isn't new information for them. And this debate isn't like a shocking, or it shouldn't be like a shocking thing. Like this idea that the Hale Center Theater might have exploitative practices and might be operating in ways that are not safe. And this isn't a new thing. There's lots of people who refuse to work there for this reason and have for years. But right now, it's really hot. And maybe it's because we've got free time on our hands, or maybe it's just because the thing that they're currently doing seems so extra dangerous and so extra reckless. Can you give me kind of a rundown as you see it of like the current issues facing the company as you see them?
Sure. And I think you're right on there. I mean, everything is heightened right now for everybody, you know, with COVID and people are out of work and there's this whole frustrations of corporations versus people. I mean, I feel like that's also allowed this whole Black Lives Matter movement to become larger too, is because everybody's just really on edge and wanting to see some justice. So when I look at the Hill right now, I mean, for me, it started with how are they responding to the COVID situation? They can choose to produce shows right now in a guidance with the state policies. That's fine. But how are they treating their artists and how are they treating the public? And so LaToya, our good friend LaToya, posted on their page asking questions specifically about artist safety and if this happens, what happens here? And so she and I kind of tag teamed over a week or so, every day or so, just saying, hey, Hale Center Theater, ? And they never were responding to her question. And so that was a big, and so when that happened, a worker at the Hale started to message me, and I'm like, hey, do you have a copy of your contract? I just want to see what they say. And they sent it to me, and the first thing I saw was that they were employed as an independent contractor instead of as an employee. And that immediately, I guess also because I've got some free time on my hands and I'm staying at home a lot more. And when I saw that, I thought their artists are not protected right now. And like you said, everybody else has been like, well, duh, that's just how it goes. That's how it's been for years. So I think it's mainly the, how do they protect their artists with during this COVID stuff? How are they protecting their audiences? And then third, just how are, I think that's, those are just symptoms of how they handle their artists overall, you know?
Right. Yeah, exactly. That it's like, this is a problem that's existed for kind of just years. I mean, they've been a massively successful operation for the last 20 years or more. And you know, I mean, like, more power to them, like, to be able to make community theater this commercially viable is, I mean, it's just like, it's kind of unheard of, and it's kind of a marvel, like, anywhere.
How
successful they've been. But I think a lot of people have looked at their success over the years and kind of gone, yeah, but it seems like you're building a lot of this success through maybe less than ethical means, and you're doing it by kind of exploiting people, and you're not really like adhering to traditional professional safety standards when it comes to like some of this very high tech stuff you've got going on in your productions. And then just right now in this cultural moment, it's like, okay, this is sort of the height of ethical recklessness that we've seen from this company. And I think that,
I mean, I'm sure you remember as a young artist growing up, you're like, I just want to be in a show. And then if you get to be in a cool company that has a lot of flash and I get to be on a stage and there's a really large audience watching me, I mean, that's an attractive offer. Actors aren't just in it for the money. They need to be in it more for the money, but they're not just in it for the money. They're in it for their art and what they're contributing to their audience and that feedback that they get from their audience. And I think that it's really easy for a company to say, we're providing this extra experience to the actor, and that's worth what we're not paying them.
That's kind of been the line for years from the Hale, and it's been adopted by places like Centerpoint Legacy Theater as well. And I'm hearing this second and third hand from people who have worked there who said, yeah, I approached kind of, this was at Centerpoint and at Hale, I've heard this for years. I approached management and said, hey, you know, how come, are you guys, do you ever have plans for paying your actors more? Are you ever going to kind of like ramp up the stipend or like ramp up the pay? Because it seems like you guys are doing pretty well. Is there any plan in works to eventually pay people more? And the answer is always, you know, we just don't really want to attract that kind of crowd, which that right there always has just been the, like the ickiest thing to me as a professional actor to hear.
Like, yeah, like what does that mean?
Like what the hell are you talking about? And what it means, like, and what they say is they're like, we want people who are really here for the passion of it and who aren't just here because they're making a paycheck. We want people who are here because they love what they do. And it's like, okay. And I talked about this with Latoya yesterday. We did a recording for her episode. And and it's like, hey, anyone who has chosen to be a professional theater actor does it because they fucking love it. Trust. Like, we are not in this field because we're making so much money. being said, it would be nice to be able to approach my craft as a real job and actually know that I have benefits and that I'm taken care of and that I'm being protected.
Well, that also touches on, you know, if we're giving these experiences for people to do stuff without pay or for minimal pay, that is an opportunity of privilege that not everyone can participate in. I mean, I remember in college applying for like internships and apprenticeships. And when I found out that, you know, I'm not going to be paid for a full-time job, I'm going to have to work other jobs in order to support myself.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, that's outside of my realm. I'm not in a financial position to do that. And then lately we've been learning, you know, especially for the BIPOC community, that's often even more outside of their reach. And so, yeah, I mean, I guess that's what I wanted to say, is that it's just doing stuff for free is not an opportunity for everybody.
Right, exactly. I hadn't heard it put like that, Dave, and I think you're right on the money there, that the ability to go and pursue a hobby for little to no money on the side is absolutely a privilege. If you've got the free time and the ability to drive to and from rehearsals every night after your regular job, if you've got the financial freedom to do that, that's great. And especially if you get to do it at a place as amazing as The Hale, if you get to work at a place that's the state-of-the-art facility with millions of dollars going into their productions, and you can see it when you walk into the theater, that it's like, wow, this is like on the level, if not kind of fancier than Broadway. Like it's almost out savvies Broadway productions. And so like it's amazing, but it's not a quote opportunity that's available to everyone, because not everyone can afford to take that much time away from their life to invest into something if it's not going to cover their gas or their expenses. And I do think, and I don't want to misrepresent what people are making at The Hale. I think that a lot of actors who work there are making enough to pay their gas and, you know, add a little extra pocket change on the side to a little supplementary income, but it's certainly not a living wage.
Well, and let's step into that. I actually have the payment schedule for their upcoming production of A Christmas Carol.
Yeah, let's look at that.
And so and I also have their rehearsal schedule as well. Now,
oh, perfect.
Obviously, yeah, they mostly rehearse from like 6:30 to 10:30, but then there are times when they say the end time is when we're done. And
which is
anecdotally
something that
you
just can't do that when you're working union. When you're working professional, you cannot.
You just can't.
You just can't. But go ahead.
Yeah. So I've heard anecdotally that sometimes rehearsals, especially during tech week, will go until 1 a.m. or 1:30 or something like that.
Yeah, I've heard of callbacks going till 1 a.m. Callbacks for a show that you're not cast in.
You're not getting any money for that. Yeah. So when looking at the rehearsal schedule, I said, okay, let's just assume it's from 6 to 10. So they're doing 4-hour days. Anytime that they're – and then let's also see, well, what could it be? And so A Christmas Carol, they've hired a cast that has done it before. So they've planned a shorter rehearsal schedule. And so I'm anticipating about 60 hours of rehearsal, maybe up to 100 hours of rehearsal on that show.
Okay.
And then I don't know what the – performance commitment actually is, but I budgeted, you know, like 3 hours of performance, taking that you come early, you do your stuff, and
yeah,
whatnot.
I think it's at least 3 hours.
Yeah,
Yeah.
So I was trying to be really conservative for them on what the time commitment was for people. And then when we, so what they're getting paid is they get paid a, I believe it's $20 or $25 a rehearsal.
Okay.
Up to a max of $600. So with the rehearsal count, they're going to get $500 if they attend every rehearsal for this show. And then after that, they get a performance wage that varies on the character that they do. And when I plug it in and I count up all the hours that they're doing, Scrooge, the top guy, he's making maybe $17 an hour.
Okay.
Whereas most of the people are making $10 an hour. And then they've got some kids, you know, on the cast, they're going to be making about $5 an hour. So at the look of it, $10 an hour, okay, that's above minimum wage. That's great.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also, they're performing way late into the nights. And also that's before they have to pay their own self-employment taxes on that income because they are classified as independent contractors and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And talking with some people, some local actors here, they said their accountants recommended that they set aside 40% of their independent contractor earnings for taxes and whatnot. So,
we can almost cut that in half.
I'm really making $6 an hour. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah,
because it can be boring for people.
Yeah, and the more that you break this down, it's like you get to that initial number, $17 an hour for principal leads, $10 an hour for featured ensemble. For a lot of people, again, people who are used to doing this for free, people who are used to doing this for literally nothing just because they love it so much, this is a hell of a deal. For a lot of people.
It sounds awesome.
I mean, I was talking yesterday to someone about how similar this situation is to the way that I look at NCAA football or NCAA basketball, but mostly football because football is such a massive moneymaker for the universities. You talk about, I mean, you look at most of these players and it's like, these are kids who love the sport, the game of football. They love it. They eat, sleep, and breathe football. And they've spent most of their lives playing football for free and to crowds of mostly just their parents and friends. And they would play football anywhere that anyone would let them suit up and play. But they get an opportunity to play at a stadium in front of 50, 60, 70, sometimes 100,000 people every week on national television.
Yep.
They get to be stars for 4 years of their lives. They get to be superstars, rock stars. And they get to go to school for free. I mean, in some ways, it looks like a hell of a deal. It looks like a screaming deal. But you break it down and it's like, yeah, but this is a multi-billion dollar industry. And they're not making any of that. And so you have to kind of make it relative to what, like, because if the Hale was truly paying their actors every cent that they could possibly afford to pay them, it would be a different story, you know? It would be like,
oh yeah.
It would be like, wow, that's amazing that you guys can afford to give that much as a small community theater. But as we all well know, they're not a small community theater.
They're not. I mean, I only have their financials through 2017. I've requested the later years; they're on their way. But in 2017, they brought in $21 million of revenue, and that's between their ticket sales and their foundation and grant support and what they get from the state and city and whatnot. And they banked $1 million in what you would say consider profit, but they just rolled that over into the next year from that year. So they had $1 million extra that year. So that's one of the things. And I think that this whole coronavirus stuff right now has just brought this to a head, even for the individual actors. I mean, we have some of the actors, like you say, that are so grateful and think they're in an awesome opportunity right now. And they can't understand how people are complaining, thinking that they're being mistreated. But there's other actors that are silent because they are worried about future employment. But I mean, Hale just canceled their performances for the next 2 weeks. And actors will not be paid for those performances as of right now.
Yeah, let's talk about this a little bit. Let's talk about this. Two actors, correct, have tested positive so far, right? For the Mary Poppins cast.
Let's see. So originally there was one actor that tested positive over Independence Day weekend.
And it was sort of swept under the rug and it kind of came out like in a comments section or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because they say that the actor had no interaction with the cast for the 48 hours prior to diagnosis and then afterwards.
Which also, so 48 hours is not enough time. Yeah. Like, how do they not know that?
You know, and they're going by what the state says they need to do. Okay. And but you can be asymptomatic for like 8 days or something like that, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, it's whenever you're like, I got to go to the legal definition of what we're doing as opposed to let's just use common sense and common decency. Yeah, it frustrates me.
Which so also kind of seems happened. To be, sorry to cut you off, but it also kind of seems to be the modus operandi for this company is always like, well, what is legally allowed for us to do rather than what is ethically or morally, you know, pressing for us to do. They're always looking at like what they're allowed to do versus what they should do. And the fact that it took this long to suspend the production of Mary Poppins, not close it, but to suspend it is kind of infuriating. Yep. And then also they're not closing both the shows that they have in production right now. They're only suspending the one that had the sick audience or the sick cast members. But there is no follow-up on testing the rest of the cast, on figuring out if they contaminated their audience. It's just kind of, hey, we're not legally required to, so washing our hands and walking away.
I believe that they've made an offer to their cast and crew to pay for testing costs if their insurance doesn't cover it. I think that's a really recent offer. But I mean, before they suspended the show, I mean, there was one actor that had a scheduled vacation out of town, but then the other actor, they said, was taking care of a sick family member is what they put out there. And they didn't disclose, well, that sick family member had COVID. I suspect. I believe. That's what I've been hearing. And then now that they do have confirmed that two cast members had COVID, and that's why they closed down Mary Poppins. But like you said, they are not closing down Bright Star, which is in their companion theater. They say that the two shows are completely separated, that there is no cross between them. But I've heard reports that there are dressers that work on both shows. And for those that aren't theater people, the dressers are helping to remove and put on costumes pieces on you while the actors are unmasked during the show. And then also in their makeup rooms where the actors are putting on makeup, there's not adequate social distancing. Now, granted, each show has their own makeup area, I believe, but the actors are unmasked, putting on makeup, prepping for the show. And so they're just not being forthcoming and open about what the actual things are. They just go back to, well, we're working with the health department, and the health department says we're meeting our needs. So,
that was a funny quote too. I saw a quote from Mark Dietlein saying, we've been working very close with the Salt Lake Health Department, almost like we brought them in. We asked them to come in and check and make sure that everything's okay. You know, we've just been working hand in hand, partnering with the Salt Lake Health Department. Isn't it true that the reason they have to work with the Salt Lake Health Department is because a complaint was issued against them with the Salt Lake Health Department, and the Salt Lake Health Department had to come in and step in and make sure that they were doing everything technically, legally, properly? I mean, the way that they frame it is like, we're working with them, we're partnering with them. But I think what actually happened was they got called out, and they had to work with them.
I don't doubt that artists in the community and or members of the public that were either going to the shows or had heard that they were opening the shows may have complained to the health department. I would hope that the Hale had reached out because they did put together their list of guidelines for this COVID stuff so that they're making that public on what they were going to do. I would hope that they would have run that by the State Department or the health department.
Yeah,
I can't confirm either way, but I would not doubt that the health department's hurt hundreds of people. I mean, I had a friend that messaged the health department asking about the Hale, and she immediately, like really quickly, got a canned response that says, we are working with the Hale and they're meeting guidelines. And I'm like, okay. So somebody at the health department determined, you know what, I'm tired of answering these emails. let's just write out a form letter so that we can make sure that we respond as we should.
Yeah. In other words, they're getting enough people asking, yeah. Is this safe? Is this okay? That they've just gone, look, we're just getting, yeah.
Yeah.
So, okay. I mean, yeah, again, I should clarify that I'm going to speculate all over this conversation because that's just what I do. And like, I might be totally wrong. Yeah. And I'm glad that you're correcting me on the things that you've been looking into. And that's why I'm talking to you, because you seem like the person who's been like really digging in and trying to truly learn as much as you possibly can about this situation and not just fling around baseless accusations like I do. But that's kind of what I liked about the way that you went public with this, is that you've been coming at it with so much information and with so many numbers and stats and like research, and it really doesn't feel like a just kind of like hashtag cancel Hale just cause, and believe me, they're really bad. What made you feel like you wanted to go public? Was it just that you had extra time on your hands, or was it like that you saw something that you thought – I mean, you sort of mentioned it, that you felt like these actors, these artists aren't being protected right now.
Yeah. So, I mean, I run a small company, mm-hmm. and every year we're trying to pay our artists more and more. And so I was learning about, you know, should they be employees or independent contractors and whatnot, and talking with other companies, other theaters that at one point had been doing as the Hale and hiring people on as independent contractors with relatively little protection, and had been corrected by the state, and so they made the change and were doing employees and stuff like that. And I love our community, our theater community, so much, and I see so much potential and for what we can be contributing to the larger arts scene. I mean, and that's why I got involved with the Salt Lake City Arts Council as well, because I'm like, hey, my artists that I know don't know how to get funding for things. And I'm like, well, let's attend some Arts Council meetings. And then I got on there. And so I've been trying to spread the word of, hey, these are resources available to us, because I feel like the people that get the money out there are the ones that know how to. And so the Hale has grown really huge because they know how to run a business. They know who they need to talk to and what grants and what people they need to get on their boards. They're making connections. And
right.
I have a mad deal of respect. A mad deal, I never say that phrase. I have a lot of respect for that they, as a company, have grown so much and have accomplished so much. And are the largest community theater in the country. But it has always irked me that they leverage, hey, we're a community theater, but on the other side of the coin, they say, hey, we're a professional theater. Because in my mind, professional theater means that you're taking care of all of your staff and they're being paid industry wages on things.
Right.
And they've not been doing that. And so when I saw that they were ignoring LaToya's posts, I was just like, you know what? It's tough for me to speak out in public about things. I mean, you mentioned like call out culture and all that stuff. I hate it, because I always feel like if I'm taking one person's side, I'm not acknowledging the truth of the other person's side. But this felt like a principle that was pretty clear cut to me.
Yeah.
When I look at the law, when I talk with attorneys, when I talk with state agencies, it feels like it's a no-brainer. The actors, because of the nature of the relationship with their employer, should be considered employees and should have the rights as such. And so when it was so obvious, I'm like, well, the reason it's not happening is because no one's calling them out on it. And their artists are not going to call them out on it. They want to continue to be employed, or they're happy with the situation.
Yeah.
And I doubt that I'll ever work with the Hale. So I figured I have nothing to lose. So let's start being a little louder.
Yeah, that's how I feel too. That's why I was like, sure, I'll talk to Dave, because it's kind of always been my position that that I'm probably never going to work there. And so I've always been comfortable just saying how I feel about what my opinion of what I think that they're doing.
Good.
The way that facility operates and looks and runs looks to me like I should be able to get the best payday of any theater company in the state working there. And yes. It's like the fifth best payday in the state. And while being the largest community theater in the country. And that's, I mean, in the country, there is no one. So when we, when we talk about $21.9 million in a year, you know, maybe to people who are in bigger businesses or bigger industries, they think that's not that impressive. But if you knew anything about the profit model of small theater companies, you'd know that, that those are gargantuan numbers. I wonder what your take is on, like we said at the beginning, this isn't the first time that they've been criticized. And I mean, obviously the reason why I haven't worked there is because I've always had issues with them. This isn't, there was an incident years back that was kind of infamous where a stagehand like had his jaw ripped off by a moving set piece. Because they're very famous for doing these kind of really intricate, like hydraulic set moves and set pieces where things are coming in from the sky and moving in from coming up from the ground. And they have a hydraulic stage that rotates and it's kind of their thing. But they had a stagehand who got caught between two moving pieces and it kind of like ripped his jaw off. And,
well,
like,
I want to say something about that. Yeah, he was he was underneath the stage. I don't know if it was a stagehand or an actor, but yeah, he was underneath the stage and he got caught in the moving stage and was severely injured. And the Hale, as a theater knows, well, if there's a mess, clean it up. And so they cleaned up the mess. And then OSHA, you know, the big government agency over safety and whatnot, came in and said, whoa, if something like this happens, you do not clean this up. You leave it as is so that we can come and do a review and an investigation and whatnot. And they played the, oh, I'm sorry, we didn't know that card. And promptly, I bet that they at least paid $5,000 in fees or something on that because of that. And I think they're just, even if they were to like come out and say, hey, we didn't realize that we should be hiring our actors as employees, I think, I'm sorry, you're bringing in $21 million a year. That's more than enough for you to know better.
Yeah, and you can't play dumb. Yeah. But again, it's the question of legality versus, you know,
totally
morality or, you know, where it's like, well, technically we're not doing anything wrong. And again, I go back to college football where it's like, hey, if the, you got to show me a harmed party here. You've got to show me how we're breaking the law. Like, we're not doing anything illegal. This is how this runs. The players who came to play here knew what they were signing up for when they signed their scholarship deal. They knew they weren't getting paid. They knew that they were just getting free school and the opportunity to compete for a job in the NFL. They knew that that's what they were coming on here for. Just like the Hale can go, our actors know what they're signing up for. Our technicians know. Yeah. Nobody's getting the wool pulled over their eyes. So where's the harm here? But just like you just said, it's like, hey, it's not really about what you can do. It's about the fact that you should clearly know with how successful you are that you should be trying to do more to protect and provide for the artists that are building the product that is making you a fortune.
And I get it. I mean, labor laws are written that, you know, it's more advantageous for the employer if I can classify my staff as independent contractors because it's less expensive for me. But it's definitely more advantageous for the worker if they can be an employee. It just makes things infinitely easier. We have a lot of actors right now and a lot of everyone right now that's a 1099 contractor that is putting in for unemployment because the CARES Act allowed for 1099 employees to file for unemployment. You generally can't otherwise, but they're getting denied and having to call and there's no one to talk to and it's just an unfamiliar territory. And so I know that there's actors likely that right now, because of the Hale suspended their production for the next 2 weeks, they're not getting paid. I'm sure that the Hale's going to say, hey, go get some of this unemployment that's from the pandemic. And they're going to try and they're going to realize, well, this is difficult and I'm not going to get anywhere near what I would actually be making at the Hale,
yeah,
which is still subpar.
Yeah, so and that's the other thing that we didn't talk about earlier when we talked about breaking down the pay in terms of hourly and going, hey, look, it's $10 an hour. It's $17 an hour before tax. But then you go into everything like what you're just talking about, Dave, where it's like, what happens if we have to shut down and I lose my job? Do I have proper recourse to still get paid or have my contract paid out? Do I have access to unemployment? And then we get into stuff. And this is why unions are so important. Things like health insurance, like being able to have benefits. I can have benefits through Actors Equity. If I work 16 weeks a year, I can be covered for the entire year through Actors Equity. And the Hale doesn't have anything like that for their independent contractors.
Nope. They don't. They're kind of just left on their own.
Yeah. The reason I bring up the OSHA incident is to A, illustrate how long-standing these kind of issues have been with this company, and also to kind of illustrate the problem with not having standardized safety protocols in place when you're operating such a huge institution. But also to talk about the fact that it seems like through the years they've been pretty resistant to criticism and to calls for reform. And when people like yourself, like when you try to say, hey, guys, what are you doing? You know, you take a very concrete example just like this, reopening in the middle of a global pandemic while all union theater companies across the world, including Broadway, are shut down indefinitely.
Yeah.
And you take this and you go, hey, what are you doing to make sure your actors are safe? And we can't get a straight answer. And I just wonder what your take is on why it seems that this company is so resistant to criticism or even just basic inquiries on how it is that they're trying to show up for the people who work for them.
I think it's mainly because they've been able to for so long. I mean, back in probably 2007 or so, Ellen Fagweest at the Tribune at that time wrote a long article about Hale compensation, you know, bringing to the attention of the public that, hey, the heads, you know, Sally Mark and other people are making six figures while everyone else is making so little. And she specifically interviewed some of their board members and said, hey, what are your thoughts on this? And their board members in the article said, whoa, I had no idea that they were making that much. And when I read that, I'm just like, their board must exist as a rubber stamp organization. They don't really have a lot of oversight there.
Right.
And since then, I believe that the pay for those executives, I mean, Mark and Sally Dietlein, they together make over $500,000 if I look at the 2018 tax returns, you know?
Yep.
For the Hale, which are public available to the public, just throwing that out there. It's not like I did anything secretive to get those. And so their pay has continued to increase, which you would expect as the organization grows. And for other comparable $21 million organizations, I'm sure that what they are making is alongside of that. But it's nothing compared to what any other arts organization here in the state is making, except maybe Utah Symphony Opera.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only larger arts organization in our state.
Utah Symphony Opera, that is a professional company.
Is a professional company, works with the unions, and they are not hiring musicians for $10 an hour.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Exactly.
So, yeah, they were called on it in 2007, and I've heard from people that, you know, are close to them that said, hey, they just kept quiet and tried to get through it until people forgot about it. And I think that's a repeated action. I'm looking up, I'm trying to get a hold of this lawsuit that apparently happened between 2006 and 2009, where some local actors that you and I both know probably were deposed and provided witness testimony in a lawsuit against the Hale and a couple of other theaters in the state for this exact thing of hiring actors as independent contractors instead of employees. And they say that the results of the lawsuit was that the state won, saying, no, you have to reclassify them. Now, most of that, what I just said, is anecdotal, but I do know the actors. I know they're real people, and I trust that they actually participated in the lawsuit. And so I'm trying to look that up. But I mean, even if that happened, I can totally believe that the Hale would say, okay, we understand. We'll make these changes. And maybe they did for a while, but they aren't doing so now.
Yeah, that's crazy. That's crazy to me. I want to also follow up with that and look that up and see if we can find out what the actual ruling on that was. Because if that's true, again, that's crazy. Even if they lost the lawsuit, it goes back to my point of like, it's wild how much heat has been on this company for so long, and they continue to sort of brazenly, almost like arrogantly, dig in their heels and just say, like, you can't make us.
Yeah.
Like, no, we're not going to change. Like,
I think it goes back to what I said. Yeah. Those that know the law know the systems, they can work it to their favor.
Right. That's what a lot of the people working there are saying right now. My friends who are working there are saying, look, they're doing everything in accordance with the Utah state guidelines. And I want to go, hey, first of all, Utah's trying to reopen schools right now in a time that's way more dangerous than when we originally closed schools. So, like, don't trust the Utah mm-hmm. state guidelines put out by Gary Herbert and his team. You touched on something where you said they've been able to for so long that it kind of promotes this idea of like, why would we change when we've been able to run successfully yep. like this for so long? And I think that for the people who work there too, it's kind of like, I don't have a problem with this. Like, why would I speak out against them? They treat me great. They feed me. There's food at the theater a lot when I show up. They're very nice to me. They know my name when I show up. Like, I love working here. The shows are always sold out. The audiences love coming to watch me perform. Like, I have an actor's dream. And I think that this goes into something even a little bit more nefarious, which is the susceptibility of people who are really passionate about what they do to exploitation and manipulation. It's right back into college football where it's like you take a kid who loves what he does enough and who has a dream and who believes in it enough that he's willing to put everything on the line, his physical safety, his long-term health in order for a shot at achieving his dream. Talking about college football players here, that's why I'm using he pronouns. And you wind up with a person who's very susceptible to abuse and manipulation and exploitation, and who might later on in life as an adult look back and go, I probably shouldn't have accepted that level of mistreatment.
Yeah. It's definitely an abusive relationship. And there's two things I want to say. One is, the actors themselves that are being vocal about, hey, it's a good situation. They're saying, hey, the Hale has told us, if any of you feel uncomfortable and want to bow out of the production, go right ahead. You will not be blackballed for the future.
Right.
But we know as theater artists, we are constantly drilled and the show must go on. Or if I leave the show, then I potentially am ruining it for 50 other people.
Right.
And that's a lot of pressure for an employer to put on an employee or an independent contractor, excuse me. I remember talking with people affiliated with the Grands production of To Kill a Mockingbird recently, which closed, a week before they were going to open. They said that every rehearsal they were having this discussion was to check in with their cast saying, how you feeling? You feeling good about moving forward on this or not? And ultimately they were like, that's just a lot of your emotional baggage that you're putting and responsibility you're putting on your cast and crew.
Yeah.
When really you as the producer, you should be making that call for them.
Absolutely.
You should be looking for their welfare.
And that, and I can say, as a person who's lived a lifetime in this industry, I am highly susceptible to just taking any job that's offered to me out of sheer flattery. If someone calls me up and says, hey, do you want to do this thing for $500? And it's like this, like a month long of work, and that's all I'm getting paid. But I'm like, but they asked me. They found me. They sought me out, and they looked at my body of work, and they wanted me to do it. So yes, I can make it work, even though I'm probably going to wind up paying my own money in order to do this project. I can make it work. I am highly susceptible to manipulation and to exploitation because I just crave doing this stuff and I crave validation so much as a person in this industry. So I need decisions to be made on my behalf by my union and by the theater companies that I trust in order to protect me. Seriously. I'm not ashamed to admit that. Like the union makes calls on my behalf all the time that sometimes frustrate me, but I'm like, if they didn't, I'd be putting myself in all kinds of shitty situations and getting exploited all the time because I just love to work and I love to act and I love to make theater. And so thank God I've got people out there who are looking out for me, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I wish that there was more of that out here. I mean, if the Hail was going to really say, hey, you can walk away from the production, I think the only way that you could do that without taking advantage of the artist would be to say, you can walk away from the production and we'll pay your contract fully.
Yeah.
And if it's just in the show, we'll pay down everyone else's contracts fully as well.
I mean, you're so right because I want to be delicate here because I have a lot of friends who are currently working at this theater company, people I love, people who are so talented. And that's another reason when we say, how are they getting away with this? How do they keep operating? It's because, in my opinion, another big thing is because we keep showing up and working for them.
Yeah.
And we keep validating that what they're doing is fine by us. And we're happy to come and lend our expert level artistry to their productions. And we're happy to be treated the way that they treat us. And as long as we keep validating that, and as long as we keep letting them know that we don't have any problem with it, they're going to continue doing it. But again, like, I don't want to speak for the experience of my friends who are working there right now who are saying, I love working here. No one's putting a gun to my head. No one's forcing me to work here. I'm happy to be offering some people some light and some music and some fun in this really dark, confusing year. And I'm happy to be doing what I'm doing. I don't want to take anything away from anyone else's experience, but you're right on the money, Dave, when you say that it really shouldn't be up to them. It really shouldn't be a decision that we ask these really vulnerable people, are you okay with coming back and performing some more? Because for a lot of actors, if you ask them, would you like to come back and perform? It doesn't matter like what the circumstances, the answer is going to be yes.
Yeah. I've had a couple of actors that have messaged me, you know, saying, hey, the Hail is taking great care of us and all this stuff. And the first thing I say to them is, I'm sorry that the Hail has put you in a position where you have to defend them. Because they won't. And I think that's one of my biggest frustrations is that the management is not coming out and not engaging with the local community. They're just standing by and letting their little soldiers of the actors go out and be put in these stressful conversations with the public for them. And the second thing is that, yes, there are a lot of actors that are very happy with how it's going. And they say, I don't feel like I have a gun to my head, but I have received messages from current staff and past staff that say they do feel like they have a gun to their head. They don't feel like they can say or do anything to get a better opportunity right now. And they feel obligated to stay there. And so those that have left, I admire them. Those that are staying, I understand because many of them are trying, you know, they're paying for food for their kids and their rent and all that stuff. It's a difficult position. So I'm really grateful that you're speaking up about this. And it's been awesome to look at the conversations that have happened on other people's walls because of the posts that were that I've been putting out.
Yeah, one of the first posts that I saw that you put out, and this goes back to why I think this whole thing differs a little bit from what I typically see with call-out culture, where it's kind of like, I'm just going to like put a person's name on a list of other names and say hashtag bad people, and like you can figure yeah. out what they did. Stuff like that where you're like, well, do you have any like evidence or facts about these people? What I one of the first things that you posted, again, and you said that this is public information and it's not something that you did anything like you had to dig into any records, but you posted, I don't know if this was the first thing you posted, but it's the first thing I saw, the salaries. And we've already talked a little bit about yeah. this, but I thought it would be kind of fun to see if you and I couldn't take a look at kind of the breakdown of where all of this $20 million goes and see if we couldn't figure out a way to come up with an extra million or two to disperse amongst the artists.
Oh, gosh. Sure. Yeah, let's jump at it. I mean, I've got one of their tax returns up in front of me right now. But what was that breakdown? I'm trying to look through my
posts. I've got the breakdown in front of me that you have, that you posted.
Great.
So you've got...
I'm almost there.
Yeah. So it says $4.5 million from contributions and grants, $16.6 million from program service revenue. This is where the money comes from, where it goes. We've got $4 million approximately, of course, to production costs, $4 million to occupancy, which, God, if you've seen that building, that makes sense. It is a massive, crazy yep. building for a community theater to be put in. Most community theaters are operating out of things that look like a consignment store in a strip mall. Salaries are the $6 million to salaries. So starting with the DEET lines, we've got Mark with 260 and Brent Lang, I don't know that person, with 248 and Sally DEET line with 225. Again, public information, we're not doxing anyone or saying anything that isn't publicly available. Michael Fox, Chief Operations, 153,000. Casey Udy, Staging Tech, 172,000. Robert Kinmont, Stage Management, 148,000. Quinn Dietline, Vice President of Development, 139,000. And Dan Morgan, Sound Direction, 110,000. I mean, all of these are just killer gigs to have in the arts. Killer gigs.
Oh, and in Utah, yeah.
Amazing. Yeah, I mean, in Utah, it's like there are actors on Broadway who aren't making $260,000 a year, who aren't making $200,000 a year. And they're paying rent for a New York apartment. These are killer gigs. Right off the bat, before we even get into salaries, one of the most glaring things to me whenever I go see a Hale show, and I haven't been to a Hale show in years, but every time I've gone to like support a friend or something, one of the most glaring things to me is we could easily knock off $100,000 of this set budget, still have a stunning set.
So easy.
Like, so easily. So when I see $4 million for production costs, I'm instantly going, I think we can easily take $1 million out of that. I think that you can.
I think so easily.
Easily. I think that.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you're like you said, you're a practitioner of a small theater company. You know how cool of a thing you can make with 10 grand or even less sometimes, that you can really, with some creativity and some imagination and some good partnering, you can make something that really looks and feels quite legit and professional and cool and slick. Now, with this company, we're usually looking at set designs that cost anywhere from $200,000 to $300,000. And all I can think when I go watch the show is, I'm sure they could have built something for 50 grand or 60 grand that would have been really awesome, that would have looked really, really cool.
That goes back to what they feel their audience is paying for. They think their audience is paying for the tech more than the performers.
And this is why I have this speculative idea that they own the companies that build the sets and own the companies that make the costumes, and they pay themselves basically to create them, and they're also so I also feel like Sally and Mark aren't just making this money from Hale. I think that they're actually running other companies that
support
organizations. Exactly. Yeah. And they have income from that as well. And so it's like, well, if the set budget is $300,000, and then that's what we have to be paid in order to build the thing. And so maybe 100,000 of that is materials, and the rest of that is kind of payment for our builders and stuff like that. And then also we get a little cut of that because we're the ones who run this company that, you know, I don't know. That's my speculation, but I just am like, I've worked in top of the line theater companies where the set budget is a fraction of what their set budget typically is, and it looks incredible. So even if they think that what their audience is paying for is that top tier technical dynamism that they're known for, I still think that they could produce that with a smaller production budget.
Completely. And a small side note related conversation is like when they feel like they have to, you know, have 300 umbrellas floating down from the stage or whatever and all that, I just feel like they aren't trusting their audience to get theater. Like yeah. They're wanting to paint over everything as much as possible.
Yeah, that's another good point.
Yeah. That's another conversation.
Yeah, I mean, but I did a production of American Idiot with Good Company Theater up in Ogden. Uh-huh. And we wanted for our set design a bunch of TVs. And obviously that's going to be a tough thing to come by with our small budget. I can't remember what our budget was, but it was very, very, very small. Mm-hmm. But we were trying to get somewhere in the vicinity of 20 to 30 TVs that would all work for our set and could all display this big giant audiovisual display we were trying to do. And again, it's going to add some sparkle and some razzle dazzle to the stage, but it's also something we didn't know if we could come up with. And we found a way. We literally put out a call to the people in our cast. Just if you know anyone who's getting rid of an old TV, let us know. And we found our TVs and we stocked that thing up with all these different TVs and we figured out a way to make it work. And it looked freaking awesome. Like it looked amazing. And we did it with no money. So there are ways that you can get that razzle dazzle if that's what you're after for less money. And also, yes, I agree with you, Dave, that God, give your audience some credit. They don't always need the stage to rise and fall 40 times a production and for, an aerial display to be happening during the Dream Ballet. And yeah. So I would say conservatively that we could cut $1 million out of their production budget. That's where I'm going to start.
Easily.
So we're going to go with $1 million right there. $4 million for occupancy, we can't really do anything about that. If that cost is
locked. Yeah, we don't really know about that. Yeah, it's probably pretty set.
Yeah. Now we get into the salaries, which is the part where, I mean, it's dicey because we're talking about, you know, people's money here. But just looking at it from a comparative standpoint to what other people running similarly sized theater companies are making in the country and in the state, right off the bat, I look at Sally and Mark and I go, I think we could knock them each down to 150. And that's
easily. And that's more than fair. I also wonder what they're doing, what their roles are, you know?
Yeah.
How are they both needed? Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think you could easily knock them both down to 150.
So they're a combined household income of 300K. They're going to be fine. Again, you're making so much more than what anyone else who's the president of a community theater is making anywhere in the country. You're still making so much more money than anyone else. So let's go ahead and start right there. And then, of course, I think, yeah, we have to go to this guy, Brent Lang, probably the same thing. Again, 150.
Well, him right with Quinn, they're over development. So that is over fundraising and bringing cash into the theater. So I get that needs to be an expensive employee. But, I mean, combined, they're paying $390,000 for their development staff.
Right. At the very least, we could again knock their combined income down to like 300 or down to like 280 or something where it's like, hey, it's a high paid position, and it's a position where you're going to, especially in the state of Utah, it's a livable wage, it's a really workable wage, you're going to do all right with that. And yeah, you're in charge of audience development for this massive theater company. But what were the reason why we're I'm being so harsh with these cuts is I'm looking at it and going, the major glaring issue with all of this is you're underpaying the people who are making the product. Like you're exploiting the thing that is the company. Like, yeah, audience development's big and running the company's big, but you don't got shit if you don't have those actors and those designers and those technicians. That's the thing.
Completely agree.
You don't have shit
They're
without
vital
your magic makers.
To your mission. Yep.
Yeah. So yeah, and then I think with the rest
you got
of these,
nothing.
It's like you bring them each down to like a cool 100,000, all the people who are a little over 100. You know, you still
They're
give
still
them each.
You're making a great wage.
You still give them each six figures. And we're looking at, you and I just grabbed an extra $2 million for artists and technicians and stagehands. And maybe that doesn't add up to a whole lot more for each individual person, because I think they probably employ hundreds of people each year. But it's enough more to maybe change their status so that they're a professional theater company and they're working with the unions. It's enough more, even if they don't want to do that, to just show these people that they really do care about them, and not just in word, but in actual deed. I don't know. Do you think that I'm being too harsh with
regards,
those?
No, I don't think you're being too harsh at all. I mean, even if they were to just keep paying people what they are, but classify them as employees and paid payroll taxes and whatnot, I'm estimating that's about $1 million a year for what they're doing.
Yeah.
And so you just found out how they could pay that. To at least pay them the minimal expected of any other worker in the state.
I mean, it doesn't even take a lot of imagination to look at this budget and figure out where you could get the extra money. It's like, yeah. I was just spitballing, you know? But it's like, it's not like something that you have to go, geez, every penny's accounted for and really necessary. It's like, there's clearly some bloating going on here. And
yeah.
I mean, if I wanted to, I'm sure I could do the same thing with a lot of staffs of big college football teams too. But that's a conversation for another day. But it's the same kind of issue of exploited workers, an exploited workforce, and people at the top making way more than their fair share. And it's not to say
now, let's
that
be clear. There's a lot of There's a lot of other theaters in the state that are doing the same thing, mm-hmm. but no one is at the scale of this.
Yeah. Yeah. No one's near it. It's not uncommon for the people at the top to make the lion's share. And that's not but again, none of their actors are going to be making six figures with an amended budget. None of their technicians are either. No one's going to be getting rich off of taking a little bit away from the salaries of the people at the top, but it is just going to allow them to more comfortably embrace that working situation. But again, I doubt that that will ever change so long as really great actors and really great directors and really great designers keep showing up to work for them.
Yeah, it's going to be tough. I mean, I've talked with a lot of state agencies this week, and they say that they're going to be opening some investigations to see if anything wrong is happening. But again, I don't know. We have a lot of distrust in our government system, you know? And so I'm hoping that we can keep this visible for a long period of time until something does happen.
Yeah. Yeah, man. I really appreciate the fact that you took the initiative on this to really kind of dig into the legal definition of independent contractor versus employee, and to get these numbers out in front of people, and to kind of once again try to get some noise around this kind of issue. Because I think it also might just seem to people who aren't involved in theater, like, who cares? Like, I think that people are just kind of like, yeah, that's your thing, and we honestly don't care. Like, even for audience members, they're like, I don't give a shit. The actors seem happy, and I like the shows at the Hale. I don't care, you know. What's the big deal? No one's being harmed here. It's very similar to you know, trying to criticize something like the FLDS church, where you look at it and you go, well, we could have a lot of women from this church coming forward and saying, hey, no one's forcing me to be here. You know, I'm happy. I like my life and I love my church and I love my religion. But it's like from an outside perspective, you look at it and go, yeah, but I wonder if you would be saying that if you weren't in the vulnerable, susceptible position that you are, and if you weren't being manipulated in the way that you are being manipulated. And it's hard for me to say that about people who I love and respect and say, like, I think you're getting a little bit duped here. I think that you're kind of getting hoodwinked by some people who are getting very wealthy off of your talent, and you're just excited that they're allowing you to sing on their really fancy, cool stage. And yeah, it's a bummer, man. I wish that we had more self-respect, you know, and that we were like, but maybe
That's it.
Yeah. Who knows? Maybe
it's realizing your value and then standing up for that value.
Yeah.
And people think, well, I'm getting more value than I did in the past, but yeah, but you deserve so much more.
Yeah. Well, yeah, man. Your theater company is also one of my favorite companies in the state. I think you guys just do consistently incredible. And you're still with Sackerson, right?
That's right. Yep.
Yeah. I just think you do such phenomenal work. And I also think that it's such a great example of something LaToya and I were talking about yesterday, because I said, how do we make theater more financially viable for people to get, like, more affordable and accessible for audiences? And I think that projects like Sackerson, and there you see them in every city in America, these small kind of startup companies that are really radical. But, like, that to me is the move. It's just, like, reintroducing people to what theater is and reintroducing people to live storytelling in a way that they're not used to, and not giving your audience what you think they want, but, like, taking the responsibility as the artist in the equation to show them something that's really going to blow them away, and something they didn't know they needed, you know?
Yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah, that's one question we look at with every show is, like, why do we have an audience member in here? What does it matter that they're here? How is this different than film? Don't like the, I go into a dark theater and I sit down and I'm invisible. So let's embrace the live aspect of things.
Yeah, I hope that you guys continue to grow in positive directions, and I hope you continue to do that cool stuff that you're known for doing. Because I think what happens to a lot of companies is they get so reliant, like once they start hitting a little stride of success, they get so reliant on the model that got them there that they're really, really scared to do anything different. And I think that might be also sort of linked to why the Hail hasn't changed. It could sound like I think that there's a lot of mustache twisting and lots of just like, we will never let go of our money. But like what could really be happening is that they're just like, this is the model that got us to where we are, and we're really scared of changing that. Yeah.
I think that's a huge part of it. They've built their success on this model. It's difficult to make that change and trust that you can still have success. I think you hit it right on the head.
Yeah. Well, cool, man. It was great talking with you. And
yes,
I'll keep looking out for your posts as this thing unfolds. And who knows? Maybe.
Who knows?
Yeah, I think that the conversation I had with LaToya was all about, like, where we want to go with diversity in theater moving forward as we come out of the pandemic. And, God, maybe this is a cool moment for American theater to start moving in some exciting new directions. So we'll see.
I hope so. Thank you, Austin.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. I appreciate it. Yeah, man. This is a tough one for me to put out there. mainly because, and I said this many times while I was talking to Dave, just because I have so many friends who have worked for Hale Center Theater and who are currently working for them. People that I really love and respect. And I don't want this to come across as me lobbing an attack at them or at their decision to work where they want to work and with whom they choose to work with and for. It's obviously your prerogative and your choice as, an independent artist out there trying to make things happen and trying to find places and spaces where you can perform in and be seen doing your thing. And it's tough. It's tough to make those calls. And I think that I just don't want this to be construed as me putting the blame or the onus on the people who choose to work there. I know that I say stuff like, this is not going to stop until we stop working for them and we stop letting them know that we're okay with this treatment by showing up to their auditions and but I don't want that to sound like I'm saying it's on us, because I think Dave hits it right on the head when he says it's really, the onus is really on the producing entity and on the producers. Like when he says that his response to people is, I'm so sorry that you've been put in a position where you have to defend them. Or like that production that he mentioned where they kept asking the cast, are you guys comfortable with this? Is everyone comfortable with this happening? It's like, that's an emotional burden that they're putting on their workers that they shouldn't be. It shouldn't be on the kids who play for a multi-million dollar organization at a big 1A NCAA school to speak publicly on whether or not they feel like they're being treated fairly or compensated fairly. The decision and the onus is on the people at the top. And I want to make sure that that's clear, that that's where I'm coming from, is this is about the people at the top in this scenario knowingly and willfully not doing the right thing and continuing to utilize exploitative practices in order to make themselves wealthier. And it's not just the Hale, obviously. That's the example we focused on in this episode, but I'm just curious and interested in the susceptibility of people in my field and people in similar fields and just people in workplaces the world over to the susceptibility to accept an exploitative work situation, the potential for that and how that gets created. And I really don't think that it's ever the worker's fault or the worker's job to fix. If you're out there and you're working for the company right now, or you have worked for the company in the past and you felt personally called out or offended or attacked, please reach out to me and let me know if you feel like I misspoke or if I'm getting something wrong about this situation here. That you can reach out and tell me about your situation and let me know and see if we can't get maybe a more balanced perspective on this thing. Because, I speculate a lot in this episode. And I said that in the interview, but I'll say it again here. There's a lot of speculation for me being thrown around. I think Dave is a little bit more thoroughly researched than me. I think he actually comes in with a little bit more facts and figures, and he doesn't really want to say anything that he doesn't know for sure, whereas I'm just sort of like spouting off my ideas about what might be taking place. I don't know. So I might be wrong about a lot of things that I said here. And if that's the case, let me know. That's all. Just something to think about and something to maybe look at. I don't know. What do you think? Let me know. Was this interesting to you? Was this thought-provoking? Hopefully. People Pleaser is written, edited, hosted, and produced by me, Austin Archer, with original theme music also by me. You can hear more of my music by going to austin-archer.com or by looking up Austin Archer wherever you stream your tunes. I have a new single out. It's called Sweet Rejection. It's mixed and mastered by Chris Bjorn over at Marmalade Music, who also mixes and masters this show. Marmalade Music does all of my projects. You can use Marmalade Music for your project. You can go to marmalademusicslc.com. Let them know that you listen to People Pleaser. Take 20% off your first project. So that's really cool. Again, marmalademusicslc.com. Tell Chrissy Bear that you love People Pleaser, that you think the host is really cute, and that you think he's really cute too. And those are the three big things you got to do. And he'll give you 20% off your first project. Thanks for listening to the show. Love you so much. Okay. Bye-bye.